Pues, eso era el slide, el último slide de ayer. Para memorizar un poco, hemos empezado con el porqué de criminología comparada, porque hemos llegado a puntos más internacionales, la unificación europea, la caída del muro de Berlín, etcétera, etcétera, estas cosas. También hemos discutido las varias tipos de investigación, como case studies, parallel studies, etcétera, etcétera. Después, los motivos por qué hacemos estudios comparados, ¿no? Pura descripción, aprender algo de otro país para usar en su propio país, o una perspectiva interpretativa. Hemos elaborado la perspectiva interpretativa, hemos visto varias maneras y varios temas teóricos, epistemológicos, para saber, para entender un país necesitas comprender por lo menos un poco de la cultura, de la historia y tal y tal. Y hemos terminado con unas agendas de investigación posibles en este estilo de criminología global, que es más necesario ahora porque tenemos mucho más crímenes globales que no paran a las fronteras. ¿Vale? Okay. Y ahora continuamos de nuevo en inglés. In this new strand of comparative criminology, we look a lot at anthropology, because anthropologists, as we've discussed yesterday, were much ahead of criminologists when it comes to looking at other countries and trying to analyze other countries. So in the global criminology, we look a lot at the anthropologists. And Arian Apudai is one of the more influential anthropologists, of the cultural anthropologists of this moment. One of his key themes is that culture used to be very closely geographically determined, but he argues that today culture is not so much geographically determined anymore, but is reproduced more and more through global patterns. He argues we live increasingly in different, what he calls, landscapes, cultural landscapes, at the same time. Which means that with your parents you live in another culture, let's say, than with your friends on Facebook. Or that in your neighborhood you live in another culture than maybe other guys in the same street can live in a very different culture. This is the idea that you have to keep in mind, that we all live in different landscapes at the same time that are not geographically determined. Take one street, that is the best example, I think. Take one street and take two families, and one family lives in a completely different culture than the other, which can be due to ethnic circumstances, which can be due to the level of education somebody has. But the idea that we live in the same street, so we have the same culture, is no longer valid, argues Apudai. We have many cultures in every country and in every person. And he says, well, he distinguishes five, what he calls, landscapes in which we all live. First, it says we live in ethnoscapes, which ethnic group we identify with. We are Catalans, we are not Spanish. We are Negros, we're not white. So you identify with a certain ethnic group. You see that in gang cultures very much, though you see increasingly mixed, racially mixed gangs. Most gangs are either black, or Hispanic, or white, but you look at your peers more or less. So you live in an atmosphere. You go to university and maybe you find a very mixed group, but you go home and you hang around with your friends and they're only black, for example. Right? So you can live in different ethnoscapes at the same time. An ethnoscape is the ethnicity you connect with, which can be different from anybody else. You live also in technoscapes. The technoscape can be, for example, your participation on the internet. People used to have friends called friends who lived close to them. Now you can have 3,500 friends through Facebook, which is a different idea of friends, but nonetheless, some people are very much very active on the internet, for example. Others just look at other people's Facebook pages. And again, others don't have any Facebook at all. And there are parts of the world where internet is not possible, for example, because there are no lines that are strong enough to transmit the signs. So you see also a strong divide how you connect with the world, either as a personal choice or because of technical limitations. If you live in an area where there is not even electricity, well, you're not connected much to the world. That is a more traditional part. So these technoscapes determine also in a way your scope of the world. Your scope of the world can be television, but it's increasingly internet. And we speak about the new analphabetism in the sense that people who are not connected to the internet are the new analphabets. I know it's a bit different in Spain, but for example, elderly people in Holland have serious problems filling in their tax forms, for example, or doing their banking. Because if you do not want to do it through the internet, you have to, it is possible, but it is an enormous hassle, and you have to go there, and it's not facilitated. The whole all systems are geared towards using the internet. Now, the internet density in Holland is about 95 or 96%, so that's pretty much. But, for example, people of my mother's age have trouble. We have to help our mothers doing that stuff. But that is called the new analphabetism. We live in technoscapes. Some of us with a very open perspective at the world, some of us with a very narrow perspective at the world. We have all our own internet groups. You can, I don't know which internet chat boards are the most popular here, but you can live in a completely different world of people who, well, who like to collect muñecas, right? Just a site for all kind of people who like to collect dolls, who like to who love trains, who like child pornography, who like jihadi discourse, right? So you have niches on the internet, and you participate on various niches on the internet as well. It's also a kind of your culture. The importance of the internet can hardly be underestimated. We live in finance scapes, which are by definition very global. Every time you use your bank card, you are connected to a global network. The banking is controlled not only by the World Trade Organization, World Bank, which are global organizations, but also by the International Monetary Fund, and all the big banks are connected with each other. So the finance scape is probably one of the more global, next to the technoscape, where we are continuously connected with the rest of the world. Mediascapes, very important. Our culture is what we also get from the media, from the mass media. What can we see? Well, you know that Google has been closed off in China, for example, and that China has developed an alternative to Google, where you cannot see politics as sex, I think was excluded, that you cannot see them. Well, there are other regimes that you cannot, that do not allow you to see certain things. But don't think that our media are not biased, the Western media, they're also biased. What doesn't fit in free market ideology is very much marginally represented in the media. So our culture and what we think, our whole system of values is very much also geared to the media scale. Now you know that there are maybe in the whole world, if you have five mega big concerns in media, then it's already a lot. Right? Murdoch being the biggest, Springer also a very big, Bertelsmann, Springer a very big one. Fininvest from Berlusconi was in Italy big, not internationally, but you can see that a few powerful companies run the media, if you like. And so this has consequences. And then the ideoscapes is your belief system. Are you a nationalist? Are you a jihadist? Are you a free market adapter, so you have also a belief system. You meet, you do not meet with people from Convergencia, but you meet with people from CUP, or vice versa. So you also look for people with similar ideas than you have. Now this is the idea with Apu Darai has outlined, that you cannot say that we are living in a particular geographical area, thus we have a lot in common. Increasingly, what we have in common is determined by other factors. These are these five elements. Okay. Or shall we just have a small, I didn't realize that this was the last slide, honestly.
Prefiero
continuar un ratillo porque hemos justo empezado. Vale. Perfecto. Now this leads us also to the idea: what consequences does it have for criminology? Has criminology been always the same in every country? Well, after the first class, you can already say that I don't think it has. It has not. So the goal is to see how traditions in criminology vary from one country to another, from one part of the world to another. And I distinguish Western Europe, North America, Latin America, and Africa. And what it shows is that the cultural, historical, and political context does matter, and particularly in the critical criminology, which was my object of study to see in a European context why criminologies are different. But particularly in critical criminology, you see this difference very, very clearly because it's simply the most political paradigm in criminology. So it's logical that the differences between countries are more visible in critical criminology than in criminological theories that claim to have a universal value. Now, where did criminology come from? Criminology came from France and Belgium first in the 1830s, the statistical school of Guéry and Quetelet. You probably remember from yesterday the international start of criminology with Durkheim, also comparing comparing statistics, existing legal statistics from different countries. That was what it all started with. Plus later, but that was after Lombroso, the environmental school of Gabriel Tarde y La Cassagne in France, who was the first step towards more sociological criminology. Lombroso and Ferri very much focused on the individual, their idea of atavism, which was very much a kind of theory that some criminals had a kind of missed a step in the evolution. Later on, it was criticized very much as a rather racist theory, because what Lombroso was actually describing were the physical characteristics of the immigrants from southern Italy. That was very much criticized by Tarde y La Cassagne in France, who argued that the laws of imitation, but we are not born as criminals, but we imitate other people, and La Cassagne, the famous quote of La Cassagne, every society has the crime that it's deserving, very much in another mode of thinking, the tradition of the bacteriology of Pasteur. There is a basis, and in that basis, if it's warm and wet, the bacteria grows the best. So you can say, well, there is the bacteria, but there is also the basis in which it is embedded. And with that idea, they came also to the idea that some societies can be very criminogenic. Poverty or big differences in income are criminogenic. Now, this is the start of criminology, and it came linked to criminal law, mainly by Franz von Liszt, the governmental project, or what is called the social defense school. Well, that's very well known in Spain. And, Britain came rather late, in fact, in continental Europe. Now Britain is one of the largest criminological schools, but later Britain picked up with a more psychiatrical criminology. So the origin of British criminology lay in psychology, and it was one century after criminology had developed in Belgium and France. You can see that in the early 19th century, I don't know if you've seen that series, the Modern Criminal Science series. I don't know if it's available in your library, but that's the oldest series of books that were translated into English. So today we can say, well, everything comes from America, but in those days everything came from Europe and was then translated into English. In the early 1900s, the books of Ferri, Sociologia Criminale, were translated. Tarde, Les Lois de l'Imitation, was translated. Bonner, Criminalité et Conditions Économiques, was the first Dutch full professor of criminology. Nice book, very often considered as the first book in critical criminology, because it was very much a Marxist orientation on political economy. Interestingly enough, in this series, which were about 10 volumes, Lombroso was not translated. Lombroso has, up till very recently, never been translated into English. Nicole Rafter has, in the 1990s, only translated Lombroso. Lombroso was not translated. Lombroso was translated into French, was translated into German, was probably also translated into Spanish, I'm sure, because the Latin American reception, as we will see, is very Lombrosian. I stress this point just to show that Lombroso was not important in English-speaking criminology. Very much in Spanish-speaking criminology. So this is interesting if you look at the early days. First to see that it went vice versa than now. Now we see, well, the theories are developed in America and they come to Europe. But then it was the other way around. From the 40s on, well, most of the theories we deal with today, all these names, Parks, Shaw, McKay, Merton, Sutherland, Matza, Becker, Hirschi, Felsen, all Americans, all gringos, all Yankees. Now, this year is, of course, not a coincidence. This year is not a coincidence. And if you look at the development of criminology, it's the development of political, economic dominance, and it's the development of war. In 1940 was the start of World War II. Why? Because World War II, in fact, meant the moral bankruptcy of European positivism. I have to look at the next slide. The moral bankruptcy of European positivism. Why? The Lombrosian perspective in criminology was the dominant one till World War II, particularly in Spain, Italy, and Germany. In Holland, Lombroso was not so important. As, in England, he was not so important. But in Germany, he was extremely important. And the first German association of criminology was called the Kriminalbiologische Gesellschaft, la Comunidad Biológica Criminal, de Biología Criminal, which was a scientific organization, but just like with lawyers who all had to become a member of the Nazi party in order to keep the professorships. The same happened with criminology, and you see that this criminal biology association was completely Nazified. Now, Lombroso theory is not a Nazi theory. Let me put that very clearly. And he wrote excellent stuff also on organized crime, etc., etc. But the whole idea of atavism was captured by the Nazis to show that, of course, they know very well who these atavist delinquents were. These were the Jews, these were the gypsies, these were the homosexuals. So the atavism theory of Lombroso was connected with very explicit political choices to say, well, he is typically the born criminal. He's the born criminal, and he's the born criminal. So in fact, poor Lombroso, his theory was completely abused by the authoritarian regime of the Nazis. Also, Franz von Liszt, who happily for him had also died already in 1919, the more authoritarian part of his theory was adopted, was completely Nazified. You also know the history, probably, of Enrico Ferri. I don't know whether you know it, but if you don't, I'll tell it very briefly. Enrico Ferri was a member of the Socialist Party. Developed a bill, a new Código Penal, where the issue of crime prevention was for the first time established. The Socialist Party did not adopt his bill, because there was a lack of means, and because they simply didn't like this idea of crime prevention. And Ferri got very disappointed. And just like Mussolini went also from the left to the extreme right, and Ferri followed him. The more, let's say, soft parts, rehabilitation and crime prevention parts, were removed from the bill, the authoritarian parts were strengthened, and has led to the Codice Rocco that Italia still has until today. It's still the fascist criminal code, with a lot of adaptations. But this is the role criminology played in the 1930s. Very much, let's say, voluntarily or involuntarily supporting a very authoritarian political philosophy. So after World War II, nobody wanted to know anything anymore of criminology. It had sold its soul to the devil, right, if you like. So nobody wanted to have anything to do with criminology anymore. So this is, according to me, this is my own theory, right? But I read sometimes also a book and it is supported by something. This is for me the most important reason why after World War II we hardly see any new theories from Europe, and most of it comes from the US. Because in the US, unlike in Spain under Franco, of course, or Greece under the colonels, for Northern Europeans like the Dutch, the Americans were the liberator. They liberated us with the Canadians from the Nazis. So the perspective of the American in Northern Europe was very positive because they liberated us from the authoritarian regime. And this is also something which works still today, I think. That the perspective has changed since the Vietnam War. It has changed, definitely. But not as radical as here in Spain or in Greece, simply because we have another history with it. Does that mean that we simply adopt American criminological theories without problems? No, it doesn't. The urban and the migration patterns are completely different. The European cities, take Girona, here, the Barrio Viejo, Amsterdam as well, you have the old center, and everything around it is a bit newer, a bit newer, a bit newer. The typical pattern of a European city is a medieval or slightly younger center, and all the time the more the city expanded and the newer boroughs are at the edges. Not so in America. In America, the cities grew very quickly and everything that was old was demolished immediately, and also the city centers were completely new. Sometimes I say the European cities, if you look at the height of the buildings, are like this. It's low in the middle, it goes like this, and the edges, you see the high buildings. In America, it's the other way around. It's the residential areas outside of the cities are very low buildings, and the center is very high. So in that sense, the structure of cities is completely different. I've been various times to the US, and all the time I make the same European, typically European mistake to think that the city center is where the action is. It's not. It's on traffic junctions far out where you do not expect anything. But it's a completely different idea of city planning. The same with migration. You had criminological theory, the development of the city of Chicago, probably very elaborately. Well, the city of Chicago in less than 50 years grew from such a small hick town of a few thousand inhabitants to a city of 3 million in just 50 years. Well, these are migration patterns that we never had. The migration came from the American migration from first the Scandinavians, the Dutch, and the English, and later on many Italians arrived, Greeks arrived. Spanish came more to Latin America, yeah? But that was the mass migration. The European migration is of much later date. Yeah? Spain was a country of emigration up till the 1990s, I think, and then only started to receive immigrants. Holland had immigrants after the liberation from the Duque de Alba, your friends in Madrid. We have been occupied by them as well. but it was longer ago. Then, for example, the Spanish and Portuguese Jews came to Holland. So that was the first stream of migration. After the decolonization, people from the previous colonies came in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and then the guest workers, and then the asylum seekers. So we have several waves of migration, but not to the extent of the United States. The United States is a country with only immigrants, because the ones who really lived there were all killed nearly. The Indians, the American Indians. So it's a country of immigrants. So that also makes a big difference. Also on how you look at, let's take questions of identity that we were talking about yesterday. Politics, legal culture, social structure, politics. Two-party system, which most European countries do not have. Legal culture, first it is a common law system, which is the English system, which is much less ruled by law. It's more cases. Case law is much more important than written law. It does not have the principle of legality in the sense that we have. And very typical for America, many legal functionaries are elected. The district attorney, the fiscal, they are elected persons. Judges in the Supreme Court, the president appoints judges of the party where he belongs to. So it's a much more politicized legal system that we have. It's not the typical Montesquieu type of division of powers that we have. It's also based on a division of powers, but the politics have a much more dominant role. And the social structure, well, obviously, America did not have nobility, for example. It, in that sense, a much more egalitarian country. Hence the American dream, if you work hard enough, you can achieve everything you like. That if it's not true, has been demonstrated over and over again. I think still Merton has played an important role in unraveling that myth. But nonetheless, it is true that the traditional status symbols of Europe, the church and the nobility, are not there. In that sense, it is a more egalitarian society. Social ideals. I don't know who of you has experience in the US, but once you describe the European system of welfare, you say, so you live in a socialist country. No, not exactly. We also live in a very market capitalist society. But for them, everything where the state plays a role in regulating society is already socialist. The American dream is as less government as possible. Now, we go that way, but it's not our tradition. Our tradition is that the state, especially in Northern Europe, we speak even of the nanny state. The state takes care of everything. Now we're moving in a more neoliberal direction as well, but this is the tradition. And of course, the level of violence is incomparable. The level of violence that gangs commit, you should not make comparisons with that, because we do not have that. We do not have gangs murdering around and murdering each other that much. The gang wars in America, particularly in the 1990s, were serious stuff that is simply not there. And also the institutional violence, even when the Mossos Esquadra have also La Paliza viene en la mano. Sometimes it's not comparable to the institutional violence that you can see in America. I just want to point at capital punishment, for example. It's sometimes a joke that America could never join the European Union simply because it has capital punishment. You know, maybe in a more recent past, that East European countries, when they joined the European Union, one of the first things they had to do was abolish capital punishment. Spain has abolished the Garrota in 75, but that was way before they entered the European Union. With the capital punishment, America is in the industrialized world about the only country with capital punishment. Very exceptional. Also, the idea of chain gangs, which is in the southern states, like Alabama, re-established again, where prisoners are gated to each other again. Work in the fields, chained together. Particularly Alabama has a bad reputation in that sense. Violations in prison, beatings in prison. I don't say it doesn't happen here, but it's not the same level. So beware if you compare American studies with the European reality, because it's not the same. Relation with firearms. You cannot win the elections in the United States if you have the National Rifle Association against you. It's a very powerful lobby, the arms industry. Very, very powerful lobby. Now, I don't know the weapons legislation here in Spain, but in Holland you cannot have a gun. You cannot. Unless you are a member of a shooting club, and then, but the arm, you cannot save it in your home, for example. So, within Europe, the firearms legislation also differs, but it is always more restrictive than it is in the US, because in the US you have the right to carry a firearm, according to the Second Amendment of the Constitution, which was established after the Civil War between the North and the South had lost, but the South didn't trust the North that much, and they claimed the right to carry arms, to form militias, if the North would come and march in again. So it's a completely different history also, of the idea and the use of arms. Also in Europe, there are different identities. We all have celebrated the 1960s and 70s, students' movements, feminism, anti-militarism, youth cultures, the heydays of social movements. Yet, we have to see that there were certain countries in that period of time that still were under dictatorship. Spain being a clear example, Portugal, Caetano and Salazar, Greece under the colonels, they had dictatorship till 75, and the transition took till 78 in Spain. You saw a very traumatized youth in Germany and Italy who were very ashamed of what their fathers had done, and very uncomfortable with the idea that the old fascists, the old Nazis, were still in leading positions. Now, I know Spain well enough to know that rasca un poco, that the Civil War comes up also. So it's a very thin layer of history that is above it, because if you scratch a little bit, then the old conflicts, and in villages particularly, everybody knows who was on the Falangista side and who was on the Republican side. Everybody knows. But in Germany and Italy, you saw, well, everybody knew that the old Nazis had still leading positions. This is also one of the reasons for the urban guerrillas. Brigate Rosse in Italia and the Rote Armee Fraktion in Germany. An overthrow of society because of the fascist heritage. This was, of course, not the case in Holland. In Holland, we have the comfortable position that the years under dictatorship, the years under authoritarian regime, were either by the Spanish or by the Germans' occupation. It were always foreigners who occupied us. So you did not have this national idea of feeling uncomfortable with what your father did. It's coming up now with the colonial war in Indonesia, which was also pretty nasty. But there was not this kind of strong feeling that we have to make good what our father did wrong, as was the case in Italy and Spain. Well, you saw, for example, in critical criminology, what was the first critical criminology emerging in Spain? It was penal reform. It was the prison system. The prison system in Spanish critical criminology was the first thing that was the object of study. And the whole penal reform movement was seen as a part of the struggle of democratization. Iñaki Rivera has written a nice, a very good book on that. In Germany and Italy, you see the critical criminology sometimes coming dangerously close to what was then called the terrorist movements or the urban guerrillas, very much sympathizing with an overthrow of the fascist remnants of society. Whereas in Britain or in the Netherlands or in Scandinavia, for that matter, critical criminology was more oriented at the new social movements. At the social basis of critical criminology in Northern Europe, excluding Germany then, was more on the new left. It was the women's movement. It was the anti-militarism movement. It was the squatters movement. It was, let's say, the extra-parliamentary social movements that formed the social basis of critical criminology in Northern Europe.